I'm Warren Smith, and today you'll be listening in on my conversation with author, speaker, and the former general counsel for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Abdu Murray.
On various campuses or in various settings, whether it's business or other places as well, the primary question is the Bible moral? Not a book of morality. I mean, is it actually of good moral character? Does it promote racism and misogyny?
Abdu Murray grew up a Muslim, avidly studying the Quran and Islam. After a 9-year investigation into the historical, philosophical, and scientific underpinnings of the major world religions and worldviews, Abdu discovered that the historic Christian faith alone can answer, as he says, the questions of the mind and the longings of the heart. That discovery and the fact that he's a gifted communicator led him around the world, teaching Christian apologetics in both Christian settings and elsewhere, especially on secular college campuses. He came to the attention of Ravi Zacharias, and eventually Abdu Murray became the North American director and a vice president for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. And because Abdu had a law degree, he became general counsel for the ministry as well. That means that Abdu Murray was at the very center of the scandal that rocked Ravi Zacharias and RZIM. Abdu has a new book out now called More Than a White Man's Religion: Why the Gospel Has Never Been Merely White, Male-Centered, or Just Another Religion. And we will talk about that book during this conversation. But it didn't feel right to me to just pretend that the RZIM scandal and Abdu Murray's part in it didn't happen. So that's where we'll begin our conversation in just a moment.
How We Live invites and equips Christians to propel faith into action. This free worldview Bible study will spark rich discussions about some of life's most foundational questions. These 6 videos from Summit Ministries offer life-on-life discipleship for churches, small groups, and families. Get free access today at summit.org/listening in.
Abdu, I'd like to get started in our conversation the way you start your book, and that is to talk immediately about the elephant in the room. You spent a lot of years with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries and witnessed the rise and fall at close hand. In fact, I was wondering if you were going to write about it in the book, and you did. You faced the issue head on. So now that you're coming out the other end of that season, why did you want to lead the book that way, and where are you right now?
I spent 6 years at RZIM from 2015 to 2021 and got to minister alongside Ravi. And he meant so much to me before I became a Christian. You know, as an Easterner who spoke in a way that I could resonate with, he sounded like people I was related to. And he expressed Christianity. I came from a Muslim background, as you know, but Christianity was expressed by him and through him in a way that not only was logical, but was beautiful to me. And then I joined the team at some point. And the investigation into what Ravi was doing, what he was accused of, and what he ended up, we ended up finding out that he in fact did do, happened while I was writing this book, and specifically the section on women, you know, the book being about women, race, and Jesus, and how Jesus regards the vulnerable. And during the course of writing the book, what I even say in the preface is that writing a book normally results in self-reflection. And you know this as an author, you self-reflect when the topic forces us to think about whether we're actually living in accordance with that we've written about or trying to persuade others to believe. And this book is about Jesus, his heart for recognizing and lifting up those who have been trodden upon by those with power, including and especially women. So as RZIM was going through the investigation about Ravi's conduct toward women who were vulnerable, I was especially challenged to self-reflect. I've had the blessing of walking in life with a woman, and she let me share her story in the book several times, who has been terribly abused, and helping her through it in whatever way I was feebly able to do. Yet I didn't recognize Robbie's abuses of others, and part of that because I didn't want to, you know. And that's a part of the, one of the lessons learned is that when you're involved in a, in for lack of a better word, an institution, in my sense, it wasn't to protect the institution. It was just I couldn't bring myself to believe this about him, and I realized that I could have and should have earlier. But that self-reflection has led me to two, well, to actually a few conclusions, and I'll say them briefly. The first one, as I said in the preface, though, is I'm a blemished person writing for blemished people. Despite the fact that I was able to walk with someone and not only her, but another person through such terrible things, I could see what it does to somebody. I failed to see it in this particular instance. And I didn't regard those who were saying, hey, I'm vulnerable. Hey, I've been misused as soon as I should have. So as such, all of us as blemished people, regardless of how well we've regarded the vulnerable in the past, we need to examine our blind spots and be ever vigilant to see and help the vulnerable, whether it's because they have no power or because, you know, women in men's, in a men's situation where men can abuse them or based on race. Second conclusion really is that Jesus, by comparison, the unblemished one, I'm a blemished person writing for blemished people, but Jesus is the unblemished lamb, became vulnerable for the sake of the vulnerable, the most powerful being in existence. The one in whom all existence hangs, becomes vulnerable and exercised his power for the sake of the vulnerable, but also for the sake of the powerful to redeem them. And so I've come to appreciate the beauty of Scripture and the person of, and work of Christ so much more because of the experience, having walked through what we walked through, and self-reflecting as well. But where we are now, where I am now is back up in ministry. I had a ministry before I joined RZIM, which was a small apologetics evangelism ministry that was able to scholarship some several people during the time I was at RZIM. But now we're back into speaking and writing, and this book is part of that ministry.
Yeah. Well, Abdu, first of all, I very much appreciate your transparency and vulnerability in sharing that part of the story. I hope you'll, and we, and I promise you, we will get around to the meat of your book, but I hope you'll forgive me for pushing a little bit on some, a couple of the things that you just said. Many people maybe thought you were heir apparent to Ravi Zacharias in that ministry. You traveled alongside him. I take it face value and absolutely believe what you just said about, you know, confessing that you're a blemished person and that, you, that you've been through a season of self-reflection. I would like you to, though, just kind of reflect or comment on whether you and others in the senior leadership of RZIM might have a special responsibility to you know, maybe go to people or publicly say that you're sorry to some of the people that were wronged by the ministry during that tough final season. And I don't know, you and I haven't spoken in a couple of years. So maybe you did take a season away from ministry. But from where I sit on the outside, it kind of looks like, you know, RZIM folded. And then everybody just kind of went their own ways, and a couple, you know, the Lighten group formed. You started your ministry. I mean, did you think about just say, listen, I'm a lawyer. I've got a law degree from a blue chip law firm. Why don't I just go practice law and be, a, you know, for a season out of ministry and let some time go by? Did you consider that?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So let me answer the second question first then. During the time of the investigation and for the time after, I didn't really do a whole lot of ministry. I was still employed by RZIM, and I stayed with RZIM not in order to do public speaking or ministry. None of that was happening, and I frankly thought about just going back to being a lawyer and doing my own thing for a long time. And without going into great detail about the way I think the Lord actually encountered me and counseled me by people who love me, who care about people who have been hurt, in fact, and others, to go back into ministry. But for a time, that's not what I was doing. In fact, I, other leaders as well, but I can speak for myself that we spent some time trying to care for the team, the staff, many of whom, as you know, the numbers with regard to abuse, many of them had been abused themselves, not by Ravi, but just had experienced it in their lives. It's just a matter of statistics. We were going through the various forms of trauma ourselves, but also looking at how can we care for the team, but how can we also help those who had been hurt by Robbie's actions and our failure to see them? So I did spend quite a bit of time away from ministry. While being employed by a ministry, I wasn't doing ministry. Yes, I was spending some time writing this book. And in fact, in many ways, this book was cathartic for me and self-reflective for me. And in fact, we delayed the publication of this book quite a bit in order for that time of self-reflection to happen and to consider those kind of things. So yes, I had not been speaking, and other than I think speaking at my own church, I hadn't done any public ministry at all. So I'd spent quite a bit of time away and in that self-reflection. Do we have a special responsibility as leaders? Well, the answer is, and of course, yes. And in the sense of, I'm not saying legal responsibility or anything else, but the idea is when you're in leadership, now my role, of course, was as Robbie's subordinate. You know, Robbie was the sort of the top of it. I was a senior vice president, but I had an office up here in Michigan, so I wasn't in the Atlanta office every day, but I was still in leadership, you know. And I think I would say that the responsibility is not only to care for people inside the institution and take care of them because they were going through traumas as well and thinking some things through, but I fundamentally and very much sincerely believed him. Now, should I have? Well, that's obviously the answer is that I was wrong to do so. And so listening and hearing the vulnerable at that time, I think in leadership, you do have a responsibility to the institution and to everyone who supports the institution to try your best to be ever vigilant, which is what the point I was trying to make in my opening response to your question is, all of us have that responsibility, but in leadership, you have a special responsibility. Where that sits on the responsibility meter, I just don't know how you measure that other than to say, you're in leadership, that's what happens. You take that mantle upon yourself. And so I can tell you that part of that reflection is that involved in ministry again, I've learned so many lessons about leadership. I've learned so many lessons about power and power differentials. And I have gone, I will say that also a part of your question was, and I have gone to people and I have publicly apologized to those for whom a public wrong was done, who did suffer because of the publicity behind this whole thing. I have done that. I've done it privately to that person and publicly to that person. And I've had great conversations, even with some people within the ministry to rectify and reach reconciliation with them. And we're still in process with some of those folks.
Yeah. Well, just to be specific, obviously there are two people in particular, Lorianne Thompson and Ruth Malhotra, who have been outspoken since the fall. I'm just wondering if you had an opportunity to visit with either of them.
I've communicated very much but I've communicated on several occasions with Lorianne Thompson. Yes.
Great. Understood. Well, listen, Abdu, let's pivot and talk about your book because the book, talks about some of these issues of power differential and gender and race and, does it in a more apologetics fashion. But your preface and the conversation that we've had up till now, I think is, highly appropriate to sort of walk through as we, head into this part of your book. And, one of the things that I'd like to ask you about is an idea, a concept that you talk about early in the book that I do wonder if your experience at RZIM might have actually informed your writing about it, which I found to be very wise. And that is this idea of a social surge that sometimes the culture, like the undertow in the ocean, can just pull you, me, all of us along. And you identify that phenomenon as a social surge. Can you say more about that idea?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that there is a current social surge that is surging people away from Christianity. You see this in the phenomenon of deconstruction, where people are taking some assumptions about what they believed and saying, is what I believed really true? And that's okay, because it might lead to a reconstruction of someone's faith. But more often than not, it leads to someone walking away from it. And one of the chief reasons is because Christianity, with I think the polarization that's going on in the world, but also some of the politicization of belief, sort of the belief that this is aligned with a certain political party or another or whatever it might be, the social surge currently, and these happen all over the across the the decades, but the current social surge away from Christianity is fueled by the accusation or the belief that Christianity is inherently a white male religion. It privileges white males specifically to the exclusion of people of color and women. And so that is a social surge that I think is happening, so much so that the more I've been on various campuses or in various settings, whether it's business or other places as well, during the Q&A, I've noticed something. The questions have shifted. You know, they used to be, when I would speak on apologetics issues, you know, did Jesus rise from the dead? Is the Bible historically reliable? Can science and faith coexist? And those questions are still being asked, but they're secondary. They're subordinated to the primary question, which is not, is the Bible true? The question is the Bible moral? Not a book of morality. I mean, is it actually of good moral character? Does it promote racism and misogyny? So I feel, you know, if you're looking at Paul's words in Colossians chapter 4, where he says that we are to know how we ought to answer each person, then we ought to answer the questions the culture is actually asking. Now, we can answer the hard apologetics questions, but the culture is not asking those first. They're asking the primarily questions, the moral questions. And there's an apologetic value to that. So I think that social surge is important for us to recognize, and then like a salmon, swim upstream and see if we can actually address it.
Yeah. You know, in the book, you say this in a particular way, which I found to be pretty helpful. You say that historically, Christians were once viewed as dragon slayers. And now, too often in the secular culture, it's the Christians who are imagined to actually be the dragons. They are the imagined dragons. Actually, I'm a fan of the band Imagine Dragons, so maybe that's why that maybe that's why that hit me. But that was an interesting way to say that. In other words, we no longer, or the secular culture no longer really is concerned as much about the question, is Christianity true? But is Christianity good seems to be much more their concern. And you make that case historically with people like Rodney Stark. So if you want to really unpack that case in detail, read the book. Mm-hmm. And then maybe from your book, go to the footnotes and read people like Rodney Stark. But in a nutshell, Abdu, make that case. Make that case that Christianity historically has actually been a positive force for women and for people of color in history.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'll borrow from Michael Bird to make the case for women right away, is that Michael Bird points out that historically speaking, Christianity was made fun of by the pagan Romans as a religion of women and children. It wasn't a religion for real men. And why was that? It wasn't because women were running away from it because of its misogyny. No, they were flocking to it because of the person and work of Christ in vaunting women and giving them their rightful place as equals to men. And so women weren't fleeing paganism and going to Christianity because paganism was so great or because Christianity was bad. No, it was because paganism had actually devalued them and they found something beautiful in the Christian message. Then, of course, you see the various, and I point out a couple of stories of some women outside of the biblical record itself, but who were Christians, who had championed rights, who had done that, not only had their rights championed by either men or other women, but then went on to do some wonderful and great things for the downtrodden, for orphans, for the sick, in the name of Christ himself. And in fact, hospitals, you see Saint This and Saint That Hospital, and there's a reason for that. It was an invention practically of Christians, as well, for people of color. I'll go back to the biblical record. You know, you look at the way Jesus, I don't think he incidentally dealt with race, or I should say ethnicity. I don't think he incidentally dealt with that. I think he purposely dealt with it in so many areas. Let's take one specific example where Jesus, in effect, deals with two issues at one time. The Samaritan woman, not only is she a Samaritan, so she's an ethnic half-breed who's outcast by the Jews, who are Jesus's people, of course, but she's also a woman who shouldn't be talking to a rabbi at all in a private setting. And yet here she is having the ability to speak with the rabbi of all rabbis, the creator of the universe, is speaking to her. And she's got a chip on her shoulder. She's got an ethnic chip on her shoulder because he's a Jew and she's a Samaritan. She's even got a gender role issue going on with her. And I unpack this in the book. Jesus actually pierces through all of those things and says, what matters is that you are made in God's image. Essentially, he gets down to this. You are made in God's image. And to everyone else, he gives sort of like a prophetic disclosures about who he is. But to this woman, he says directly to her, I am the Messiah you've been waiting for. And here's the part that I love, is that she's so excited about this message that she leaves the water jug at the well, which is the whole reason she went there. And she, a Samaritan woman, runs back to her village, her Samaritan village, that already rejects her as a moral outcast. And she's so inspired by this man that she comes and tells her whole village, and they're so inspired by this woman that they come and spend time with this Jewish man. So Samaritans and Jews uniting together because the first cross-cultural missionary in the New Testament times was a woman.
Yeah.
That's but one example of the many that you'll find, I think, in the pages of scripture. And then, of course, one last quotation I think is worth giving is Frederick Douglass. You know, Frederick Douglass recognized the difference between the religion of the slavers, the Christianity that was used, abused, and manipulated to actually use, abuse, and manipulate others. And he says this. Now, he calls it the Christianity of this land. Now, he's not saying American Christianity is inherently bad. What he's saying is the Christianity of the slavers. So this is what he says. Between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference. So wide that to receive the one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to be the enemy of the other. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slave-holding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, hypocritical Christianity of this land. That is such a quote because he's saying, I recognize the value, the equality, not only for slaves, but also just for, because I'm African, because they're women. And if Douglass, this brilliant mind, could recognize that, I think that's worth us taking note of.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, the other thing that one other aspect of your book that I found to be pretty helpful was not just your examination of the biblical record, which, of course, you did in the story of a Samaritan woman, but you also observe rightly that many of the early church fathers were African as well. You say Tertullian, Origen, Augustine, and Athanasius were all Africans and among the most influential thinkers and theologians of Christianity's first few centuries. And you really have to ignore the historical record almost completely to accept the idea that Christianity is a white man's religion, don't you?
You do. And in fact, I try to ask the question in the book, how did we even come up with this phrase? It's a white man's religion. Because if you look at the demographics today, right now, the demographics, most Christians are not white males. By far, globally speaking, the majority of Christians are either people of color or people of color who are women. You can't say it's demographic. You can't even say it's historical because of what you just said. You know, you look at the early church were olive skinned people, and then the church fathers were even darker skinned people. And so this idea that Christianity is the imperialist religion of the Roman Empire used to dominate and subjugate darker people or women is simply, it's not only anachronistic, it actually flows against the weight of history. Rather, Christianity is the olive-skinned religion of olive-skinned origin that influenced the Roman Empire for the better. Tom Holland actually notes this in his book, Dominion. He set out to prove that all the good we have in Western society came from the Roman Empire. And then he realized there was plenty of awful in the Roman Empire, but it's actually the Christian message, as it actually, for lack of a better word, infected the Roman Empire, that changed it for the good. So really, what I think there is, we have a whole lot of sort of amnesia about the past, but we have a lot of the pockmarks of Christianity and Christendom. And we can't ignore those, by the way. We have to basically embrace the idea that there were Christians who even knew the gospel message, but didn't act consistently with it. And even today, that happens, of course. I think the reason why we've come to believe Christianity is a white male religion is because of, I think, recent events, but also a surge that wants to get this narrative out there, and it's not been challenged enough. Yes, we need to recognize the ills and the downside of what Christendom has done, but that has been inconsistent with that which Christ has done and which his church historically, or at least at the beginning phases, actually did to not only champion the equality across ethnicities, but across the two genders.
Well, let me ask you then, therefore, Abdu, to help me with some tactics, because as you note in the book, that an honest, objective reading of scripture and history would almost immediately give the lie to the notion that Christianity is a white man's religion. And yet, as you also noted, that narrative is still persistent in the culture. And that narrative sometimes takes the form of what you call the yeah, but syndrome, or what I would call, sometimes I've heard called the whataboutism, you know, where even somebody that might grudgingly acknowledge that, yeah, Christianity is okay, or maybe a Gandhi-esque kind of an answer with, you know, your Jesus I like, it's your Christians that I don't like kind of thing. When they resort to that kind of whataboutism, what do we do? What, as Christians who want to engage those friends, do we gently return them to that meta narrative, or are there other things that we can say to a person like that?
That's a great question. I think we do actually return them to the meta narrative, but also get granular if we have to. And I think we should just challenge them back on that. You know, as a lawyer, I firmly believe in the idea that the one who makes the claim bears the burden of proof. So if someone's making the claim that Christianity is an inherently racist religious system, or owes much of its success to racism or whatever it might be, or misogyny, I think that person who's made that claim bears the burden of proving that. And sometimes they'll go about it and say, well, the Old Testament, you know, supports slavery, or Paul says women shouldn't speak in church, they should remain silent, or, you know, I don't let a woman have authority over a man. See how misogynistic that is? So often if we ask them, okay, how did you get to the conclusion you came to? When you say it's this way, how did you get there? Is it because of current events? Is it because of you're listening to the media and the media sort of told you this story? Or have you actually decided, I'm going to take a look and see if the world's most influential religion, I mean, and that's not a controversial claim at all. Everyone knows that. If the world's most influential religion actually has maybe been maligned a little bit, or maybe see what it actually says. And I've been so surprised when I've turned someone to say, okay, where in the Bible do you see these problems? Now, sometimes they know and they'll go right to the verses. Most of the time, they don't. What happens is they've been fed their own meta-narrative, and that meta-narrative is counter to what the Bible actually says. And so you can counter it with the meta-narrative and say, now, we have two competing meta-narratives. You don't actually have any granular proof of what you're saying. Can I actually offer you some granular proof of what I'm saying? And so you go into the Old Testament, and as I do in the book, you basically unpack some of the issues that are there and some of the verses that are troubling, the New Testament as well. And I think you can actually begin to win someone over with that. I recount in the book a story of a conversation I had with an African-American young man who left the faith precisely because he thought Christianity was the religion of slavers and inherently was racist. And he had chapter and verse, by the way, about why he thought so. So it wasn't just the meta narrative for him. It was that plus. But we went through the conversation, and you have to be prepared for a couple of things. One, it's going to be a long one. And two, it's going to be emotion filled. One of the reasons I come to think that Christianity might be viewed as merely a white male religion is because those who are neither white nor male, or who are neither white but could be male, maybe they've been hurt deeply. And getting past the hurt requires us to actually hear what the hurt actually is. I mean, that can't be gainsaid. We actually have to listen for the hurt, because the hurt can actually create a blinder to what the Bible actually says, because maybe Christians have done that, or they've looked at their own history and the way Christians or Christendom has treated them. And so getting past that is a really important thing. But the only way to really get past that is to give a listening ear.
Yeah. Hey, Abdu, I'd like to pivot in our conversation a little bit, because sometimes it has been said that contrast brings clarity. And let's just acknowledge that your book is not written in a void, that others have been writing about this topic of race and gender and religion, specifically Christianity. And I want to kind of get you to compare and contrast your book and your perspective to some of the others that you cite in your book. So, for example, Jamar Tisby's book, The Color of Compromise, has been one that has been going around evangelical circles lately. You read that book. You said that you were instructed by that book in many ways. Can you sort of compare and contrast your perspective with Jamar Tisby's perspective?
Sure, absolutely. I think what Tisby's trying to do is give a historical survey to make a point, is that we can't ignore the complicity with which Christians have acted in either propagating racism or at least allowing it to continue. And I can appreciate that perspective. I think there are those who respond to saying maybe he went too far. And I didn't even go there in the book. In fact, one of the statements he made that I thought was actually quite astute, but I wanted to give the other side of the coin on this one because they're complementary, was he said, we can't forget that racism was so ingrained in this country that we fought a whole war to try to preserve it. You know, the idea of slavery in the Civil War. But the contrasting idea is this, that the desire for abolition and for equality was also so ingrained in the hearts and minds, especially of Christians, that we fought a whole war to end it. So both can be true. And so while I appreciate the point he's trying to make, I think it's important for us to consider the fully orbed view, because even Tisby himself says there have been some wonderful contributions to the idea of equality by Christians inspired by the Christian faith. And he himself is a believer as well. So my goal is not to give a historical survey so that I can prove the point that Christians have been complicit. I'm sort of taking it as a given in some senses that there has been some complicity, but also we can't throw the message out because and I don't think he would say that. He said we can't afford to throw the message out, because what I'm trying to get at is that the Bible or the Christian message, the gospel message, is actually the cure for the very problems it's blamed for. So I think that it's a valuable work. And I'm just trying to contribute more to the conversation, but offer not a counter perspective, but an additional perspective, additional facet that says that we can't also just ignore the good as well. And I don't think he's trying to ignore the good, but I want to highlight some of that.
Sure.
In addition to the other things that we have to own up to.
Well, and as you said, Jamar Tisby is a Christian believer. But there are a couple of others that I'm going to mention and ask you to comment on. I'm not sure that they are. I don't know much about them, but I don't think either one of them are believers. One of them is Ibram Kendi, who wrote How to Be an Anti-Racist. Compare and contrast your perspective with that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And another book I devoured, by the way, and a good book can be one you fundamentally disagree with, but you still can't stop reading. And right. I've had plenty of those. And I've even been told by some people, hey, I didn't agree with any of your book, but I read the whole thing. I think Kendi pointed out some valuable things for us to learn from, but I also think that there were some, I think, worldview issues and worldview flaws. One of the things is that Kendi goes out of his way, actually, to say a couple of things that I think are actually contradictory. One of those things is that he goes out of his way not to label people as racists. He talks about a racist, but it's as one who is believes and propagates racist policies or ideologies. He goes out of his way not to call people racist. And I think the reason he does that, and I don't know him personally, but reading his book and other books as well, I think it's because he comes from a humanist perspective. And the humanist perspective is that human beings are inherently good and that there's no real inherent sort of sinful condition we need to wrestle with. He also doesn't believe that hearts and minds need to change first. He makes the case that policy needs to change and hearts and minds will follow. The case I make here is that Kendi is examining a problem from, I think, the wrong perspective. I think that in trying hard not to call people racists, he's actually ignoring, I think, the overwhelming evidence that humanity suffers from a very serious sin problem. And so policy can't be our savior. We have to have a revolutionary heart change and policy will follow. Yes, can policy influence someone's heart and actions? Absolutely. I think that does, in fact, happen. But is that the primary thing? No, we can't forget something, that the only way a policy will change is if people actually want policy to change. Policies don't pop into existence like a quantum fluctuation or something. They're actually brought about by people, and their hearts and minds need to change. And the electorate needs to be the kind of people who want those people in office. All of that requires heart change. I think that's why the gospel is such an important condition necessary for the change of culture. And I don't think he sees it that way. So I think that he proceeds from a humanist perspective that misses the mark. It doesn't, in one sense, he goes too far. In another sense, he doesn't go far enough.
Right.
So I think that that's where the gospel provides the needed balance.
Well, one more book that's been in the popular imagination, and that is Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, a massive bestseller. Say a few words about that book, again, in relation to your book.
Well, several of the things that I find interesting in Robin DiAngelo's book is that she sort of has this view that one, white people are just racist, and you need to basically acknowledge that and then shut up and sit in the corner. Kind of, I'm very, very seriously characterizing her book. I realize that, but I go into more depth in-depth analysis than the sentence I just gave. I promise in the book. But she has an interesting phrase there. Among the many things that I find difficult to agree with in her book, she basically calls racism. She recognizes it as a moral problem, but in the same sense, kind of says it's not really a moral problem. And I think that she's missing the mark there, again, from making it where it's pervasive and it's everywhere at all times, to maybe missing a couple of the nuances that maybe it's not as prevalent or not as pervasive, but it still is pervasive. I don't want to denigrate or like limit that reality. My issue with her was that, among several things, is that the moral problem of racism can actually be solved. But I think it's by allegiance, and it sounds like I'm beating a dead horse here, but I think that the drum needs to be beat, actually, to switch metaphors, through Christ and through his message of equality. The reason I think is so important is that when she sort of makes the claim that racism is endemic and it's a non-moral issue in one sense, that she misses the mark on what we really need to point out, is that it is a moral issue. It is an important issue. But she makes an interesting point. She says it's not humanly possible to get over racism. She actually says that in her book. And that's a statement I can completely agree with. It is not humanly possible, which is why we need the Holy Spirit as given to us in the pages of Scripture to transform our hearts.
Yeah, very good. Well, Abdu, thank you so much for your book. I found it to be helpful and nourishing in many ways. Just, you know, one final question. What do you want people to get out of the book? What's if there's just like one big idea that you know, if you read the book or if you forget everything, remember this one thing, what would that be?
Oh, wow. What a great question. Here's what I would say is that God blesses us with ethnicity and our gender as an expression of who we are, while endowing us with his image as a definition of what we are. In an identity-crazed, obsessed culture where we're going off the deep end on trying to figure out who and what we are, I think recognizing ethnicity and gender as expressions of who we are, but focusing on God's image as definitions of what we are, I think that can help us.
You've been listening in on my conversation with Abdu Murray. Abdu Murray holds a law degree from the University of Michigan Law School, as well as an undergraduate degree in psychology, also from Michigan. His new book is More Than a White Man's Religion: Why the Gospel Has Never Been Merely White, Male-Centered, or Just Another Religion. A couple of quick notes before we go. First, if you're new to the program, check out the Listening In archive. I've done more than 450 long-form interviews over the past 9 years for World News Group. And these include a 2016 interview that I did with Abdu Murray about one of his previous books, Grand Central Questions, which we mentioned in today's podcast. In addition to my earlier conversation with Abdu, you can find conversations with authors, filmmakers, musicians, interesting people of all kinds. Just go to the World News Group website, that's WNG.org, and use the search engine to explore. Listening In comes to you from World News Group, and this program is just one of the many podcasts and publications available. To find out more about our complete family of products, visit WNG.org. Tune in next week to hear my conversation with Dr. Michael Kruger. Mike Kruger is the president of Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, as well as the author of what I think is an important new book, Bully Pulpit: Confronting the Problem of Spiritual Abuse in the Church. The producer for today's program is Paul Butler. Johnny Franklin is our technical producer. Production assistance comes from Lillian Hammond. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and you've been listening in.
Now We Live invites and equips Christians to propel faith into action. This free worldview Bible study will spark rich discussions about some of life's most foundational questions. Watch Summit Ministries Worldview video series for free at summit.org/listening in.
These six videos from Summit Ministries offer life-on-life discipleship for churches, small groups, and families. Get free access today at summit.org/listening in.